Good evening and welcome to this week's worldwide broadcast of The Joyner Report. Now here's your host, Angela Joyner.
Hi, welcome to The Joyner Report on UFO Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Angela Joyner. Listen live on WPRN in New Orleans. Tonight, before I introduce my guest, there's something that has come to my attention that I'd like to share with you. Alfred Weber recently published an Examiner article where the great-granddaughter of Dwight D. Eisenhower, Laura Eisenhower, along with another person, claimed Hal Puthoff was, quote, a behind-the-scenes coordinator of the secret Mars colony project, end quote. Dr. Hal Puthoff is director of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Austin, and he's been there since the mid-80s sometimes. I'm not sure how long. A theoretical experimental physicist, his research ranges from theoretical studies of gravitation, inertia, cosmology, and energy research, and a lot of other things. He's probably most well-known for his work in remote viewing. But this article that was put out by Alfred, he is quite involved in the UFO phenomena, and he sends out these articles in an email list, and I get them fairly often, so I was curious, and I asked what he thought about it. I tried to get him to come on the show, but he didn't want to do that. Now, I'm in touch with Hal Puthoff from time to time, so I did ask him for permission to read on the air his email response to Alfred to you guys. So here it is. In the email to Alfred, he says, Alfred, I see that Laura Magdalene Eisenhower claims that I'm the behind-the-scenes coordinator of the secret Mars colony project, and he uses a quote there also. I have to tell you that this is complete nonsense. You can, of course, assume that I'm lying and that I'm just a part of the secret cabal or some such, but I'm telling you the truth when I tell you that is absolute fantasy. I hate to see your exopolitical movement get marginalized and derailed by such stuff. Sincerely, Hal Puthoff. So I felt that that was worthy of noting, that Hal is, you know, telling us that there is in no way, shape, form, or fashion that's a true statement. And that's about all I'm going to say on that. Now, tonight's guest is Phoenix-based UFO investigator Larry Lowe. Now, some of you will remember that he did a special show with me back in October, and we really had a lot of fun with it. And at that time, people were saying, oh, you got to get him back to do a regular show. So I listened to you, and I like Larry and wanted to have him back here, too. He's a veteran of 3 decades of inquiry into the UFO phenomena and has recently taken a more active role in the public discussions of UFOs. He writes for Examiner.com as the Phoenix UFO Examiner. He's appeared on the History Channel as a UFO reality spokesman and is active in the formation of Evolver Phoenix, a node of the Evolver Network, dedicated to positive transformation of society towards sustainable stability. On another note, Larry will be the master of ceremonies for the Phoenix Rising Conference to be held in April in Phoenix. And before we close the show, we will get him to tell us all about that. I might mention one of the speakers there will be Mike Fortson, who appears as a witness in this documentary that we will talk about tonight. In May 2008, Larry conducted an examination of the March 13, 1997 Phoenix Lights events for Base Productions producer Chris Loft. Now, this documentary that Mike and Larry are appearing in is going to air on National Geographic February 22nd, and you will need to check your local listings for the time. Okay, the name of the show is American Paranormal UFOs Over Phoenix, and that's February 22nd, so be sure that you catch that. I thought Larry did a great job in it. I thought all the witnesses did a great job. Thanks for joining us, Larry.
Thank you very much for having me, Angela. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And thank you for sending the UK DVD version of the documentary so I could preview the show. It was good, and I really liked the graphics, and I thought all the witnesses there did a good job. But tell us how you got involved in this documentary.
Well, at the very onset of 2008, I began writing as the Phoenix UFO Examiner in an effort to do direct journalism and maybe have some impact. And that there were two offshoots of that process, one of which was I began to support the activities of the local Phoenix MUFON section headed up by Jim Mann and Stacy Wright to make sure that they got some publicity for their meetings. And the other thing was I had to take a look at the Phoenix Lights. That's the hometown case. And I was not really involved by any means in the original series of events. By late spring, I had talked to a lot of people and built a model and done some work, and it had been around. And so when National Geographic, in the form of Chris Luft, called Phoenix MUFON, saying, you know, who do you know that can discuss this case, my name got mentioned, and it's for that reason that I got involved.
Well, that is really a compliment to you that they liked your work and said this is the guy you need to talk to. So tell us about the focus of the show. There's been two events really on that night. One was the 8 p.m. sightings, and one was the 10 o'clock at night sightings that are a little more controversial. So how did you deal with that?
Well, first of all, and I think I'm going to end up sounding a little bit like Mike Fortson here for a moment, there is a general distinction being made about the 8 o'clock lights and the 10 o'clock lights. But in truth, there was a range of activity from about 6:30 through the wee hours of the next morning, all the way from Las Vegas, all the way across the state, down through Tucson, and back up again to the north. But characteristically, at 8 o'clock, there were an enormous number of reports that soared out into a number of different types of craft, apparent craft, objects, airborne somehow. And then there was a bit of a lull, and then there was a flurry of visual activity south of the Estrella Mountains. And by then, the news had begun to report what was going on, and word had spread. And it was those lighter events that were captured by several different sources on videotape. And I think one of the things that I'm proud about this particular presentation is it took a fair amount of care to sort those two things out so people understood that the iconic images that Mike Christen captured that are constantly being shown while news people are describing the large objects and kind of confabulating the issue in people's minds, these were sorted out. And the credit to all of this, I think, has to go to Chris Luft, who I believe did a very fine job of putting together an even-handed, clear-eyed look at the entire situation and boiling it down to just a couple of key witnesses, three key witnesses, actually, and telling the public a tale that they could understand.
Okay, tell us who those witnesses are that appear there.
The key witness, for purposes of this particular presentation, turns out to be a gentleman by the name of Tim Lee. And it's not for the reason that you would think, because his art was one of the fundamental images of the Phoenix Lights when it was republished without his permission in USA Today.
Oh, my.
Certainly, he's a key witness, and his V-shaped representation and his story have been well told. But what Tim Lee offered the production was something very special, and I think it's the crux of where this particular episode does its best work, and that is there was a geography, immediate and local to the area, that gave us a remarkable opportunity to deduce an actual statistic on the wingspan of the object that Tim Lee saw.
And tell us what that span ended up being and how that was done, if you would. I thought that was very interesting.
When this object came from the northwest and flew over his head and went to the southeast, it went through a little narrow area called Hatcher Pass, which is just a small V of land between two small ridges out there and a tiny little hill exactly in the center of it. Now, Lee was very focused during his observations, and he made a couple of key points, one of which was that the nose of the craft, and I'm going to say craft advisedly, it's really an object, we don't know what it is, the nose of the craft went directly over the small hill in the center of the V between these two ridges. The wingtip closest to him, which went right over his head, passed directly over a telephone pole, which he identified for us. And the craft fit between these hills, and it flew below the tops. It's almost as if this craft was like a field goal going between a pair of uprights. It flew right down the center of Hatcher Pass. Michael Tanner later talked to me and said that there was a report on the other side of Hatcher Pass with a pastor, who saw the exact same thing emerge from the southeast side of that pass that Tim Lee saw disappear from his vantage point. But because this craft was below the top of the hills and fit between them, and we know what its geometry was, it becomes very simple. If you can measure the topography, you can deduce the size of the craft. And Chris put together a surveying team with the Darling Land and Surveying Organization from Tucson. They brought up some laser scanners, and they took a meticulously detailed snapshot of that. And when the dust settled, we now know, you can state it as a fact, that the object that Tim Lee said flew over him was 1,500 feet on all three sides of an equilateral triangle.
Wow. So we're talking huge.
Well, we're not actually talking huge in terms of what was seen in Phoenix that night. There was a 2,500-foot estimate for an object that flew through the East Valley. And the most spectacular of all was an object that Max Sorensen and a number of other people reported that began up at Carefree. It was a filled-in triangle instead of a V, and estimates were that it was more than a mile. In some cases, estimates were 2 miles wide. And, of course, Mike Fortson's initial reaction when he saw the V-shaped craft that flew some 30 minutes later past his vantage point in Chandler was that thing is a mile wide. But he didn't have the privilege of the geography. It was Tim Lee's geography that let us deduce a hard number for what was probably one of the smaller craft that night. And the wingspan of a B-2 bomber is 179 feet.
Wow. So with that terrain and the witness, Tim Lee, it looked like you were using some sort of a photographic laser device to sort of pan the area to get the measurements?
Indeed. The Darling Survey Organization from Tucson has a unique mechanism that fires lasers out. It's basically an optical radar. An incredible precision, and anytime you want to build a building or plot a highway, it's a very good thing if you want to try to plot a highway, you want to put a gentle little curve in there, they can go out and measure the land with exquisite precision. And it actually took two of these scans at different locations so that we could get both sides of the pass and, in that case, stitch the data together and reference that to the vantage point that Tim Lee had in his front yard. We set the origin scan up right next to that famous cactus of his. And when you all three of these data sets were stitched together, well, then Base had a 3D data set they could put into a 3D rendering system. I had supplied them with the dimensions and the plan form for the 3D models that I'm using in my work in Google Earth. And their engineers moved it up so that the craft depicted fit relative to scale the observations that Lee made, and then they simply measured it.
Now, this had never been done before, right?
Well, you know, it's hard to say that something's never happened, but to my knowledge, this is the first time that anybody's taken a witness report and, in essence, back-engineered some scientific fact to work with. What's really fascinating about this approach is that they then took that single number and a few other details that we got carefully out from Tim, and they presented it to a science team, four or five individuals, including a physicist and aeronautical engineering professor at ASU, and said, what is it that you can imagine that would be that big, and what would be the characteristics of it? And that's when we begin to really think about what must have been going on in Tim Lee's sighting.
Well, that is just very interesting. You know, if you have the right equipment and you've got good witness testimony of really what can be done with that.
Well, yeah. I mean, we usually get a report that somebody said there were some lights in the sky and it went from about here to about over there and it went behind that barn. I'm telling you, it was the biggest thing I ever saw.
Right.
But when you quantify it as 1,500 feet and, you know, give or take a foot or two, you've got a lot to work with. ASU physicist Pavlos Michalides and engineering professor William Walcock spent some time trying to figure this issue out. And the first thing they said was, well, what's this going to have to weigh? And we knew the plan form, and we knew the size, and we knew the proportions, and they came up with a number of about 60 million pounds of weight. If you make the assumption, and this may not be an accurate one, but if you make the assumption that the object that Tim Lee saw was constructed in roughly the same manner as the space shuttle, i.e. dense plumbing, fuel tanks, instrumentation, cargo, whatever, you'd have 60 million pounds of weight to lift off the ground. Well, now you need to have 60,000 pounds of lift to counter that. And they immediately investigated the concept of how much rocket thrust would that take.
Mm-hmm.
You do the back of the math envelope, and it turns out to be it would take six Saturn V's, each one of which has got five F1 rocket engines, to generate 60 million pounds of thrust. And if
Incredible.
You mounted six Saturn V rockets in the base of a V and flew it over Tim Lee's house, you know, you'd burn all the marshmallows in all the backyards.
It would be like a tornado.
It would be.
So it would be very destructive, and yet that's not what happened.
Airplanes operate on the basis of the wing pulls enough air down and generates enough down thrust of the air, and air, in fact, does have some weight, that when that weight equals the weight of the craft, the aircraft, it then maintains an altitude. So you need some sort of down repulsive force if you're flying by aerodynamics. And there isn't any way that this craft was flying by aerodynamics, which is why I don't really like to use the term flying. It was propelled somehow.
Okay, but we still don't know how, right?
Well, I think there's some very interesting possibilities in there. They looked quickly at embedded rotors, because that's another question. Could you have a rotorcraft do all this? And the answer is fairly similar. It'd take an enormous amount of gearing and complex rotorcraft technology that we don't have right now. And so then they begin to look at the idea of an electromagnetic engine. Not too clear in the documentary what the engine propulsion system would be, but they did the power requirements for that, and they said, we don't know any way that you could generate enough power with present engineering. to power in some sort of electromagnetic engine. Now, if you talk to guys like Dr. Tom Vallone, who was out here recently at the Chet Snow Secrets Conference, about the potential for a thing called zero-point energy, you begin to realize that there is almost an infinite amount, a practically infinite amount of energy that appears to be coming from all matter. When you take the hydrogen atoms and you cool it down right to the point of absolute zero, where all energy stops going on inside an atom, a little faint jiggling going on, and I'm not the best guy to explain it, but the point of it is these things are sort of pulsing in and out of reality in a very rapid fashion. And if you generate very, very tiny mechanisms, nanotechnology scale circuitry, you can extract this energy into the form of electrical energy. And if you did that, you'd have a power source for the kinds of craft that Tim and Max Sorensen and Mike Fortson and all the rest of the people say that they saw traverse the sky that night.
Interesting.
There's another thing that Chris did. He's a part pilot. In fact, his grandfather was a decorated World War I fighter pilot, I believe, with the RAF or the Royal Navy. So he's got an aviation heritage, and he said from a physiological point of view, there's another problem that this presents, silence, and that is when you talk about these craft suddenly accelerating out of sight, and I know you saw the introduction to James Fox's fine film, I Know What I Saw.
Right.
And at the end of the beginning segment, there's three or four people in a row said, you know what, it was just going along real slow, and all of a sudden it just took off like a shot.
Mm-hmm.
We had a report from Ann Baker in Prescott, Arizona. She and another person were out that night, and this craft object that floated over their head hovered almost silently, quietly, not moving. And then as it departed, the lights all turned red, and it shot down toward Phoenix at an enormous rate.
The lights were white in the beginning?
The lights were white all along, but they turned red as the craft accelerated.
Right.
There's two possible theories behind that. One is that the change in color of the light is a factor of the motive force coming out of the light somehow. And the other theory, which I haven't really thought all the way through, is that the Doppler shift of the light itself at the speed this thing was going, maybe it was redshifted the way the light coming to us from stars traveling at high speeds is redshifted or blue shifted. In any event, if force is mass times acceleration, and you accelerate a mass to a sudden high speed from a standing start, you get what we pilots refer to as G-factor. I'm a competition aerobatic pilot, and I can tell you that somewhere around 8 or 9 Gs, it gets very hard for human physiology to stay conscious. Fighter pilots have got to use mechanisms to keep them from passing out in those G loads.
Okay.
They calculated the Gs it would take to accelerate in the time frame discussed, and I don't forget the actual number, but in point of fact, it's an absurd number. So much acceleration was placed on that craft that anything inside of it would be tomato paste on the inside back wall of the cockpit.
I remember watching that part in the documentary, and one thing that really gave me a visual about that kind of force is they said your organs would be crashing into each other.
Oh yeah. If the forces were going on inside the object,
mm-hmm.
the human body would be compressed to mush.
Right.
Now, there's a very interesting side effect that Tom Vallone pointed out to me when he was speaking down here in Phoenix. If you use zero-point energy to affect what we call field effect propulsion, electromagnetically, you reduce the electromagnetic mass of the objects inside to zero. Their physical mass is there, but electromagnetically, they don't have any mass. And don't ask me to give you the hard science behind that, because I'm not a physicist.
Well, don't worry.
The point of it is that if the mass is zero, you can apply ultimately an infinite amount of force, of acceleration, and you have no force. And what that means in simple terms is that if these craft were happen to be using field effect propulsion from a hypothetical zero-point energy propulsion device, then there would be no G's. You wouldn't feel a thing, because you were effectively outside the operating area of Newtonian physics. This is called inertial shielding. And if you can shield the inertia, you can make what you see. And I know you've seen the video of the famous video in the space shuttle of a little object traveling through the atmosphere, and a shot comes up from the ground, and it makes a sudden, I mean an abrupt, right angle turn. You've seen that time and time again. It's been described of UFOs just suddenly turning 90 degrees to the direction of travel, and it, without slowing down and without curving. You can't do that if there's any inertia to the device. And if there is no inertia to the device, that implies a zero-point energy-based field effect propulsion system of some sort. Everything that I'm telling you now, which is pretty much what Michelides and his team arrived at, is theoretically possible, but to the best of our knowledge, it's by no means engineerable in human terms.
So it's all theoretical, and as far as we know, there is no human technology that can get this done.
That's correct. And I'm reminded of the closing statements that James Fox made in his fine film, and I'm going to paraphrase them a little bit. If these objects did what they did over the observers and witnesses in Phoenix and Stevensville and Tinsdale and the Hudson Valley and Lubbock, Texas and Belgium, if these giant craft are doing this thing, then either one of two things are true. There is an enormously successful, enormously well-funded effort to create technology beyond our wildest dreams, operated by a relatively small, secret group of people that does not use it for any measurable purpose in normal human society, or we're not alone.
Yes, I remember that, and it does seem to boil down to that. You know, we had in Phoenix, you had hundreds of witnesses. In Stephenville, we had dozens. It wasn't quite the number, I think, that you guys had in Phoenix. But, you know, I know you wanted to talk about some of the similarities there. The main similarities to me are the witnesses describing how large this thing was, that it was completely silent, that it seemed to be just there 1 minute and gone the next. One of the witnesses I remember said it was going so fast that if she had tried to put her finger on it and follow it in the sky, she would not have been able to keep up with it. So what other similarities do you see?
Well, I think those are the main ones. Frank Warren sent me an email just before when my first article at the Examiner came out, and he pointed out that the Ann Baker observation of the light turning from white to red reminded him of what he remembered a report that he'd gotten or you had printed or whatever from Stephen Allen. I think there are substantial differences of a sort. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ricky Sorrell's sighting was in daylight.
Yes, it was, and it was in mid-December before the January 8th mass sighting.
That's another similarity. There have been sightings before and after March 13th. In fact, when I was down at the Rio Rico conference presenting my animation of that Sky Harbor Triangle during Lynn Patai's presentation, She showed the renderings that I've done of the various reports that that came in to me. And a lady sought me out afterwards and said, you know, I've seen that thing. And I thought, oh, good. Well, where were you on the night of March 13? And she said, oh, no, that was just 2 years ago. I was all the way out on the other side of Palo Verde, and we went out on Google Earth, and we drove down this road until we finally found a camping point. And she explained to me how it was and what it did, and it moved around, and that will be the subject of a later report. But she said, it's the same thing. So if you try to say that the Phoenix Lights is a case, you know, you're going to have a bunch of issues, and that sort of constrains your thought process. You're going to try and have to figure out, you know, were all of these witnesses somehow confused at the same time? But as soon as you open up your mind, as soon as you look at the rest of the data, and you compare in general broad terms, anything as big as Ricky Sorrells said it was, anything as big as Mike Fortson said it was, is not operating by normal aerodynamics.
Yeah, because it should make a hell of a lot of noise. And
Here's a similarity.
Able to hover.
Here's a similarity that you can help me with.
Uh-huh.
Ann Baker watched the V shape that she saw, which we believe is probably also the one that Tim Lee saw, shoot out of sight, and it went down towards New River, towards the north ends of Phoenix. And Michael Tanner shared with me a report of someone who saw something approaching at extremely high speed, and with the red lights on, and slid to a halt and almost became that 40-mile-an-hour gentle walk. And he did the math, and he said he thought that worked out to be around 3,000 or Mach 3. At Mach 3, you're going to get a triplesonic boom. That's the footprint that the SR-71 makes that's very characteristic. Mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, you told me that the radar data said that the craft at Stevensville made a high-speed dash at one point and exceeded the Mach. Is that true?
I think the highest it was clocked was about 2,100 miles per hour.
Well, you know, that waters my eyes. That's beyond Mach 3.
It's something that we should not have any capability of doing.
Well, if we did, and we were doing, if the thing was somehow physical, operating inside our air, okay, there'd be a sonic boom. So I think the lesson in all of this is that these craft are operating all over the world, and they have a set of characteristics which are common. And those characteristics preclude that they're operating on the kinds of principles that human engineering relies upon.
Well, do you think we'll ever really know what was in Phoenix or what was in Stephenville?
I hope.
What do you think it's going to take to find out?
I guess I'd have to say it would take the perpetrators of the events showing it to us broad daylight all over again. You know, if they'd like to come up to Reno to the National Championship Air Races and do a flight demonstration, I think I can get them to talk to the Dick Houghton up there, and we can give them an opportunity to display what they do out in public.
Well, since we don't really know who the perpetrators were, then that doesn't seem likely, does it?
Well, but I think they may take it upon themselves at some point. If we get hypothetical for a moment, and let's just make an assumption that whoever is doing this is an advanced civilization, they obviously feel that they need to remain covert to the broad base of public perception. This is not an unusual idea. There's any one of a number of Star Trek, the Next Generation episodes, where Starfleet has a little base in the rocks behind a hologram, and they're studying the local civilization, and they're not trying to be found. In fact, there's one very good one where they do get found, and Picard has to show up and deal with a less advanced civilization. So it stands to reason that an advanced civilization would be covert in its in its observation because they don't want to disrupt the, you know, the civilization they're looking at.
And well, we're saying advanced civilization.
Yes.
Are we really talking about aliens, or what are we talking about?
Well, I have to speak, for my purposes, in very broad terms. I think the word alien, and I use it more often than I should, is a kind of a throwback to the early days of ufology when we, in the 1940s, I mean, everybody was believing that the flying saucers were manned by tall, good-looking, voluptuous women from Venus and guys by the name of Orthon who were hanging out on Saturn, and it was interplanetary. And then later on, we had to start thinking about, well, maybe it was interstellar and they're aliens to us because they come from such large distances. I'm now of the belief that it's entirely possible, and I think some other people are coming to this, that you have to consider that they come to us from someplace immediately nearby, but unimaginably distant, and that is some sort of version of reality that is on a different, I'm just going to make a crude analogy here, a different dimensional frequency than the one we're on, and they're literally right next door to us, and they have the ability to phase into our existence, do this magical stuff, and phase back out, and they're living on an Earth very similar to ours right nearby. That would explain why they'd be unhappy when we touch off a nuclear bomb, because we may not realize it blows up things on their picnic table that we didn't realize we were doing, and they've got to get us to stop fooling around with nuclear weapons.
And so this may be why we, you know, have reports of them shutting down nuclear weapons at highly secured bases, like Robert Hastings has reported on.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that would make sense. It's kind of, I don't really have that concept of other dimensions. You know, it's very difficult for me to get that, I guess because I'm so grounded. But I, it is interesting to think that you could slip in and out of another dimension and you know, and how it's done. It's just incredible.
Well, one of the examples about that that is very not very often spoken about. You know what? Before I go any farther, I need to say something.
Okay.
I'm a new guy in the Phoenix Lights investigation, and I stand on the shoulders of a lot of people. Michael Tanner was good to share with me the work that he collected at Village Labs when he collected the reports. Jim Dilatos has been a good friend for a long time. He shared with me his insights and his work. Mike Fortson, after he saw his experience, he became an investigator. He's got reports. Dr. Lynn Katai, of course, she saw a different aspect of the Phoenix Lights. But she's been a mentor, and everything I'm going to say needs to be taken from the context, although I'm seeing it for the first time. There's a lot of people paid a lot of energy and inner work investigating this thing, some of which names won't go mentioned tonight, and I don't want to slight anybody in the process.
Okay.
So that having been said, Bill Hamilton and Michael Tanner put together a document early on, and you can find it in Bill Hamilton's book, which is hard to find, but you can link to it from the recommended reading section of the Phoenix UFO Examiner column. At around 6:30, if you go to the fairly famous rest stop we all know about on the top of the Mogollon Rim called Sunset Point, just before you drop off the rim and start traveling down into the valley, that night, if you look to the west about 4 or 5 miles, there's a little community called Crown Cane. And there was a warping flash of light out of which emerged three big wings, V-shaped craft.
I'm not familiar with that.
Well, it's a relatively unknown aspect of this. It was documented by the original investigating team, and nobody really has seen fit to mention it.
Huh.
I've illustrated it, and it will appear in an upcoming examiner column. But the point of it is, we never know where these big craft come from or where they go to. But observers at Crown King watched a flash in the sky appear, like a pulse ball of energy, get real big and then subside back down. And when it was done, there were three wings floating around, each one of which was, I don't know the numbers, but they were the typically large V-shaped craft. They milled around for something on the order of 10 or 15 minutes, at which point the sound of jets were heard coming from the south. At that point, these three craft rotated around on top of one another on a vertical stack formation flying, collapsed down, according to the witnesses, into one unit, and then there was appeared to shrink into a ball of light which winked out of existence, and the fighters came roaring through, and there was nothing there to see.
It was like they knew the fighters were on the way.
Right. And they said, we're not going to give you something to engage, and you're not going to force us to use our weaponry or shielding or anything. We're just going to go back the way we came through some sort of process with it. I'm going to postulate advanced physics that gives you access to a physical world that has a different set of characteristics than the one we've got. There are ways that you manipulate the basic mechanisms of physics, and if you start twisting at some of the little knobs, nothing works, and you can't, nothing will stay stable. And we live at the bottom of a little bucket of one of those. Our weight and inertia and mass have certain kinds of relationships. As best I understand it, there's a high hill on either side of us where things are unstable, but there are buckets over a ways where a different kind of physics applies, where you can have a stable world. And to our average perception, that world would be invisible, but it would also, in a sense, be overlapping.
Well, is that your personal view? Is that what you think's happening?
I would say I consider that. That's one of the strong possibilities I consider. I think it's very careless of a UFO investigator, examiner, to say, I know what's going on. But I think that the evidence, to me, suggests that that's the most likely thing to be going on, and you simply have to have the imagination to stretch out into some far corners where we can engineer and arrive at a possible solution that fits something. One of the things that Mike Fortson's done, and you get the same story from George Knapp and the folks up at Skinwalker Ranch, is that on a very small scale level, you hear stories of little portals opening up and people walking through them.
Mm.
All right? The Skinwalker Ranch is a very famous episode of were up on a ridge, and this door opened, and this guy crawled out, this entity crawled out, and the door slammed shut. Where did that door go to?
Right.
There's another very interesting thing to think about, and that is Cochise was rumored legendarily to be observed in the Superstition Mountains out here east of town. And the legend was he walked right into a stone rock canyon wall, and a day later was seen back in the southeast end of the state. Indian legend has it that there's a honeycomb of underground caves and tunnels and whatnot, but I'm not too sure that those are necessarily literal. If an advanced civilization wanted to monitor us, and once again, I'm referring to an episode of Star Trek, The Next Generation, they would have the technology to build a base where they could operate unobserved in nearby proximity to our civilization, and no one would really be aware of it unless they chose to make people aware of it. And that would give them the anonymity that they would have to do whatever it is they're doing. And the average person on the street would say, well, you know, how come they don't land on the White House lawn?
Right. Oh, my. It's so much to contemplate, really. But I want to take a question from the chat room now, Larry, if that's okay with you.
I'd be happy to take it.
Taldor says that in the 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. sightings, V-shaped and triangular-shaped crafts were there or were reported. He wants to know, were the lighting configurations roughly the same so that they could have been the same type of craft but not the exact same craft? Does that make sense?
Yes, and that's a very good question. I think I've identified probably 8 different fundamental types of craft, okay? Mm-hmm. And if you go to the Facebook page, you'll see the artwork, and you'll see this kind of, actually, Lynn Kitai has generously published some of my work over at her phoenixlights.network, and we presented this at Rio Rico. There's probably 6 different types of craft, but there could be subtle variations of each. There could have been lights going on and off, things changing. There is one speculation that says that some of these craft objects, I have to say objects because I'm not convinced they're aircraft by any means, some of these objects morphed. They transfigured themselves somehow. So they might appear as something to someone and as something someone else differently to someone at a different location or a different time. It might have been the same object, but have had a different appearance.
Okay.
On the other hand, there might have been simply different kinds of subtle versions of craft. You know, the B model and the C model look different.
Right. Okay. Another question I had, you know, Dr. Lynn Kitai was one of the first people that I met during that year, 2008. I met her at the X conference that year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, did she participate in any way in this documentary? Or I didn't see her footage, I didn't think, in the doc.
Well, she and I discussed it. I think there is maybe a snippet of some of her orb video taken at one bit in the teaser.
Okay.
But the answer to that question formally is no. We chose Mike Kristen's footage and his observation because, in a sense, he's kind of an icon of that imagery. Gets shown a lot, and I think Chris felt that it was part of the he was trying to build on what a lot of people have seen and make the distinction that that was not the same thing as the craft.
I'm not sure, but I think we've got about 3 minutes left here. I'm looking for somebody to give me a time in the chat room here. But I want to be sure and – oh, no, we got 7 minutes, they're telling me. So I want to be sure and touch on Jim Dellatoso's work in the documentary, that you were sitting with him and you were – watching him compare this unknown object to flares that are usually dropped in that area. Can you tell us about that?
If I was going to give you the long answer, Angela, we'd have to have another hour, which we don't have.
Well, it made a lot of sense to me.
The flare debate has been something that I think has muddied the waters and confused the issue for a long time, and I think to some degree that may have been intentional on the parts of people that said, let's give them something to talk about. But the short version is that Jim's taken a lot of hits over the years because it's never been fully explained the process that he puts together, which looks at the, and I can't even say it correctly, so forgive me, Jim, I'm not going to get this quite right. But he looks at the spectral RGB values, the variations from frame to frame to frame to frame over time, and he's looking at the characteristics of the lights over time. He's obviously not doing what a lot of people said that he claimed he was doing that can't be done, which is spectrometry from an RGB signal. And the point of it is that he had a database of spectral time-based data analysis from a large number of known objects, and he applied, he used a piece of software that wasn't readily available at the time and was not something he was free to talk about very much to run this analysis. And then he could not find a match in his database with the resulting time graph of the behavior of the lights photographed by Crisden. Consequently, he was pretty safe, and I still think he is very safe, in saying those lights are unknown.
Okay. I noticed, you know, when you're looking at, on his screen, you're sitting there with him, you know, the Chris's objects going on, they're very straight, and then when he lays the flares on there, they're just kind of jiggling along. It's and flares is something that we've seen in Stephenville now after the radar report came out on Stephenville. We started seeing just, I mean, two or three nights a week, an incredible amount of flares being dropped. And it did seem like it might be something they were using as a diversionary tactic. Because on those same nights, not all of them, but some of them, there were actually people that spotted an unknown, you know, a craft, not just lights. But it's confusing to people when you, if you've never seen flares before, quite spectacular. It was just like big fireballs in the sky, and you're like, whoa, what is that?
Well, I have the good fortune to have a support team at the Examiner who's been there, done that, got the T-shirt, worn it out, thrown away. And last fall, the Air Force announced that they were going to do a high illumination flare display at the Barry Goldwater Range, so I got together with one of my colleagues, and we put boots on the ground, and we drove out in the middle of nowhere, and we got a good look at them, and we sat there, and we took photographs, and there's the whole Examiner going to come out on that particular exercise, because there's some remarkable things that can show up on film from what you know for a fact is one of these illumination flares. The flares, the big orange, slow-moving ones, they make an excellent diversion. And if you wanted to get the public to give something to talk about and not be talking about a 1,500-foot or 2,500-foot or mile-long craft that hovers and floats silently, make them go argue about the flares. And people have been.
Well, Frank Warren is in the chat room now.
Yes.
And he's saying that Bruce McAbee proved the 10 o'clock videos were flares, and that Delatoso now agrees that they were. Do you know if he's changed?
Well, I think we have to be very careful. And I have not met Bruce McAbee. I respect him. I think from what I've read of his work, he proved the location was on the far side of the South Mountain. I've done a piece of work analyzing Kristen's video, following in the footsteps of three or four people, using Hamilton's technique. And I'm going to publish at the Examiner a version of that video, along supported by some work with some of the guys at Spectrum Video here in town, that those light objects were on the far side of South Mountain and the Estrellas. That much I think we can pretty well say. The case that they were could not be flares was always based on the idea that they were somehow on this side of the Estrellas, and in the middle of the night, the dark, grainy video. It's a difficult process to, well, in fact, there's nothing there. We even looked at the deep gamma.
Well, what time was Christian's video taken? What time? I forgot to ask that.
It was very simple. The television program had just ended at 10 o'clock, and he got up and he walked over to his kitchen sink to have a glass of water, and he looked out the window, and the first one came up, and he happened to have, not entirely coincidentally, I don't believe, his camera loaded, cleaned, and prepared, which he had taken out earlier that night for no particular reason, and he just walked right out onto his back veranda at about 10:05 for about 5 minutes, captured the video that we now all see. Lynn's, she says, was 5 minutes later than that. Steve Blonder's was 5 minutes later than that. Those folks argue that McAbee's triangulation can't be accurate, but it can be reasonably accurate if you're willing to do a little Kentucky windage. I believe that objects are on the far side of the Estrellas, but I'm not entirely sure we know what they were. And that brings me to another. I pulled up a witness.
We've got 1 minute, Larry.
I'll say this very simply. I found a witness who lives north of Casa Grande, but south of the Estrellas. They were looking northeast that night at the backside of the Estrellas, and they observed 5 hovering stationary lights in a V-shape down behind the mountain for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Phoenix Lights. And their observation argues that there was something, a large craft, hunkered down in there. In fact, their statement was, it's like that's where they parked it at night. And they couldn't figure out what all the fuss was because they saw these things, this set of lights, every night, and they were looking 140 degrees away from the Barry Goldwater Range. They were looking north, not south. But those lights still would have been below the mountain or behind the mountain, and whoever put those lights up, it was masterful. The argument can go on forever as to whether or not it was illumination flares.
Okay, real quickly, Larry, tell people how to find you and how to read your work.
Thank you very much. I am at examiner.com. If you Google Phoenix UFO Examiner, you can find me. My tiny URL is tinyurl.phxufo, and that will link to my page, which will be a list of my work.
Okay. Do you have a website, another website? Or
I do. I've got a really cool website.
Okay. Let's tell about that. We're over time, but let's go ahead and get it in.
It's not quite ready done yet, so I can't give you the URL.
Oh. Okay.
But it's really cool.
Okay,
I'm going to publish all the geographic data of the Phoenix Lights that I've got in one place, and I think when you see the big picture, a lot of people will understand. But
okay, well, let me know when you get it, and I'll announce it here so everybody can find you. And I want to say real quickly that next week my guest is going to be my husband, Randall Joyner. I'm going to talk about some things with him that occurred in the fall of 2008. I hope you'll join us for that. And Larry, I just want to thank you for being with me tonight. I really enjoyed it, and I thank everyone in the Pal Talk chat room and all of the listeners. It's been great. See you next week. Bye.
Party people!